Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Hope y'all didn't have too much trouble getting here. I don't know what time it's supposed to start freezing again, so we'll get started without wasting a lot of your time. Your panel this afternoon is to my right, Justice Lee Gabriel. To my left, Justice Bonnie Sutterth. I'm Leanne Dofano. And you are our entire 3 o'clock oral submission docket. So I understand both sides are ready? All right, then we'll get started. Would you call the case, please?
Portman Hall, Evan Stillwell versus the state of Texas. Next, Mr. Court, Ms. John A. Moore will argue for the appellant, Mr. Jeffrey Hill will argue for the state.
Okay, Don.
May it please the court. You know, I was thinking that this is a weird case, but after listening to the 130 docket, I feel better about it. So, anyway, I would love sometime in, I've been practicing before this court for 20 years, I would love at some point to come in and say, you know, my brief answers, everything the state says, I feel like I've articulated everything artfully, and I just want to have questions if you have any, but that has never happened to me, and today is no exception. I would like to address some of the things to begin with that from the state's case, or excuse me, from the state's brief, that I don't think, maybe my brief doesn't answer as much, or maybe just needs to be responded to. To begin with, I want to talk about the 3629 issue. The state says in its brief at page 10 that the juror Sanchez never stated that he could not read or write, so it's not an issue as to whether he is absolutely disqualified. And I want to point out that the juror clearly stated in the reporter's record, volume 3, starting at page 125, the trial court asked the juror, and so you're able to read and write English. And the juror says, in my job, are you asking? And the court said, no, when you filled out the questionnaire. And the juror says, no, no, no. I don't think you can get much more unequivocal about him saying he couldn't read or write the English language than him saying no, 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 and indicating that he didn't actually fill out his questionnaire or understand and read and write English when he filled out his questionnaire. State also says that the disqualification on literacy issue is not preserved here. And basically what they're saying about that is the trial court initially says to both parties, all right, so obviously we've got a problem. This juror can't read and write the English language. And the state says, well, it's the state's position that he doesn't understand the English language. And the defense adds, yes, that's correct, as in addition, we believe that. And the state is interpreting that to be, well, he was just saying that he couldn't understand it, not addressing the literacy thing. But there are actually several specific places in the record where appellant consistently asks that the juror person be removed because he's not qualified. One of those is at volume 3, page 132. I would move that Mr. Sanchez be removed because he is not qualified to be a juror. Again, a straightforward indication that reading or writing is the qualification under 3516. He also says at 133, the juror was never qualified and so could not become disqualified. Moreover, as I mentioned before, the trial court specifically said at 138, I do think the juror could have been found simply never eligible as the defense urges. But then in the face of the state consistently saying, we're asking you to find the juror disabled, we're asking you to find the juror disabled, I feel like it was akin to trying to put a square peg in a round hole. And that's what we ended up having here. We have a situation where we have a juror who was never qualified, disqualified by law, and because of the fact that the trial court recognized that and realized it wasn't fair to continue to have the juror on the jury, and excused and removed the juror, which necessitated the mistrial, that the court didn't go that one extra step at the state's urging that, well, we can get around this if you find that this juror is disabled rather than disqualified. But there was never any question that the qualification didn't exist. And I think that's the big issue that we look at here in determining whether or not, obviously, we could have proceeded with 12 jurors, or excuse me, without 12 jurors, with only 11 jurors under 3629. I will add, and it's really sort of an aside, but it could be relevant to this court, some of the cases that are cited, such as Timmons, and I think the state cites a non-published case called Allen, where they talk about the fact that the statute says be disabled rather than become disabled, and that their subpart B talks about becoming disabled, but that subpart A only says be disabled. And I would like to point out that those cases are pre the 2001 amendment. In 2001, the statute was amended to reflect the content of the statute. So the title says becomes disabled, and they amended the content of the statute to say becomes disabled. So any of the cases where they say, well, we've got this distinction between be disabled and becomes disabled, or what, there's no issue of it, whether it's a pre-existing condition, aren't really applicable in this circumstance because those were dealing with a different statute that may or may not have really meant the difference that it's purported to be. But for whether it did or not, that's not applicable here. One of the other things that the state addresses in its brief is they say that this is a waiver issue, that really this is just a 3516 peremptory challenge issue, and because it wasn't explored and addressed at voir dire, that arguing about it now, it's waived, and they cite the Webb case out of the Court of Criminal Appeals. But the Webb case is not applicable for a variety of reasons. First off, the Webb case was strictly a case where they were looking at a motion for new trial that was filed and arguing about a mistrial that had not been granted, that the defendant had requested in that case. And it was relating to whether or not a juror had been had prior service as a grand juror. And two things that the court did in Webb. One is, it really doesn't talk about this issue. I mean, it discusses it, but it's not the focus. The focus of the Court of Criminal Appeals was, are we looking at a situation where there was any kind of bias because of that service as a juror? And they really sort of focus more on the harm aspect of that and say, you know, we really didn't have any harm here anyway because the trial court asked enough questions to determine that the grand juror or the person who was on the grand jury didn't have any bias or prejudice in this particular instance, even though they may have heard that while they were sitting on the grand jury.
Isn't that the case where in that holding of no harm, they said, assuming error, there was no harm?
Yes.
So it was pretty clear that they were not really willing to go forward and say there was error.
Yes, exactly. And they focus on that harm. But I would also point out that that case was not a case that dealt with the constitutional issue that we have here. Because here we're talking about the constitutional right to have a jury of 12. That case didn't have anything to do with that. There were 12 jurors on that panel. Now, whether they all met the 3516 qualifications, I mean, the court seems to think that there was not a particular harm in that instance, even though that juror had been on there. But they had a jury of 12. I'm going to do that all day, panel instead of jury. But anyway, they had a jury of 12. They didn't have the same constitutional issue here, which was not just some sort of voir dire error. We're talking about the constitutionality of proceeding with a disqualified juror rather than the disabled juror. The other thing that's interesting about that is, I mean, it really, they don't talk about, they talk about 3516, but they don't talk about 3516 in relationship to 3629. Because one of the things is, if the legislature had intended that if a juror who had one of those disqualifications made it to a panel, or I mean, to the jury, and, you know, it was determined after the fact that was a problem, the legislature could have put in there, in addition to being disabled, if you have any of those disqualifications under 3516, we can proceed with only 11. You know, they could have very easily put that language in there. They don't talk about that language. The only language that's in there relates to this idea of becoming disabled. Because I think the purpose, the notion behind it is, things happen sometimes. Things happen, jurors get arrested, people become sick, people have deaths in the family, and those are instances that, you know, we have to address, and that's what they were attempting to do in that. What they weren't attempting to do, I don't believe, or they could have done it, was to address the situation where we have a juror who's insane or who's not a citizen, and they make it onto the panel. Those are jurors that are disqualified, and a mistrial should occur. We don't just continue without that juror. That's not what the legislature provided for, and it's certainly not a constitutional exception.
Are you agreeing that someone who doesn't understand English, doesn't read, and doesn't write English is disabled?
No, absolutely not. I'm not agreeing. They're not under the definition, I think, from the Court of Criminal Appeals, whether you use the more specific or the general definition, that they talk about fully and fairly functioning as a juror as opposed to mental, physical, emotional condition that makes them disabled. I don't believe that they're disabled under either of those because they're actually disqualified. They weren't able, they can't become disqualified later or disabled because of the qualification later. They were never qualified to be on the jury to begin with. So, and I know I'm talking about the 3516 portion rather than just talking about the 3629, but since I didn't, frankly, I didn't really even think about that as being an issue because for a variety of reasons. One is that I didn't think that case was applicable because of the way that they decided it. And then the other thing that is at issue here is that when in that case, they talked about, well, there could be instances that basically the burden would shift and that the appellant would have to show that they did ask the questions or did something in order to discover that the disability or the disqualification under 3516. Well, one of the things they also mentioned in that case is that either they had to ask the questions or it had to be in the questionnaire. In Denton County, and it's part of the record, it's a designation of the record, it's not actually sent up because it's under seal, but certainly this court could get it and it could be ordered. I, again, did not think that this was the issue here, but in an abundance of caution, it is part of the record for anybody to look at. The jury questionnaire in Denton County specifies, I want to get the language right, specifies that you are not qualified to serve as a juror if, and then it has little check marks where they can check mark any of the things under 3516. And then when they sign it, it says that you are swearing that the answers are true and correct under oath. Well, these questionnaires are filled out before the jurors get there. We all know what they look like. You have a copy of some basic information that they also gathered from those questionnaires. But it's sort of an idea that those things, those exemptions, the exemptions and the disqualifications are usually vetted prior to the jurors actually being in the veneer panel. So it's not unusual to be in a situation in Denton County where we're not going up and down the row and saying, are you a citizen, are you a citizen, are you a citizen, because that's already been explored before the juror gets into the courtroom because it is one of the statutory disqualifications. Again, I don't think any of that's really applicable, but I didn't want it to be that I didn't address it, and it turned out that, you know, y'all looked at that and thought that that was the crucial thing in this case, that somehow this was a waiver issue. One of the things on the disqualification, and I mentioned this when referring to the types of disabilities that you can have, but there are specific cases where they've said that the 3516 exemptions are not disabilities, that they are disqualifications. There's one directly on point in the Ramirez case, which I cite in my brief, where the court specifically said that the state agreed Rivera. The state agreed that the juror was not disabled. There are other instances where it's a bias or prejudice, and unless it goes beyond the bias and prejudice and goes to something more specific like somebody's mental capacity is affected because of their bias or prejudice, that's been something that the court has very clearly said we're talking about two different things. We're talking about the square peg and the round peg. And in this instance, it's clear that it's not a disability, and if it's not a disability, then the remedy is a mistrial. The remedy is not to proceed with 11 jurors, which is what happened in this case.
Thank you.
(Clears throat) May it please the court, counsel. I'd like to start off with one of the arguments Ms. Moore first indicated was that the juror stated that he did not, could not read or write, and that I mischaracterized the evidence. On page 11 of my brief, I have done quotes from the third volume record, page 126, where they're discussing, are you able to read and write English? He said, in my job, are you asking? And the court responded, no, when you filled out the questionnaire. Juror Sanchez did say, no, no, no. The court said, you didn't fill out your own questionnaire. And the juror said, well, yes, but barely, not too much. So my argument on that is that there was not a definite testimony that I cannot read or write any English or that I did not fill out this questionnaire. The testimony is that he did fill out part of it, but barely, but not too much, whatever that means. And it's hard to get from the record any further elaboration on that because the juror's understanding of the questions being propounded to him were often not understood by the juror. And that was a problem in communicating in this case. I did raise the preservation error issue because, in fact, I did infer from when the judge said, I think we're all in agreement, he cannot read or write English. The state said, no, that, we're not in agreement as to that. He can't understand the English language. He's not understanding what's happening or being said. The defense attorney responded, that is correct. And my inference of that, and I guess you could, listening to Ms. Moore, you could infer it either way that he's arguing, yes, that's correct, meaning, yes, that's correct, I agree with the state, or I agree with the state and the judge. My point was he never raised the inability to read or write as the reasoning behind his request for a disqualification. He did continuously urge for a disqualification rather than a finding of disability.
So your position is not being able to understand English is a disability?
Once you've gotten past the voir dire portion of a trial without that having been found out in order to raise it as could have been raised as a challenge for cause. Once you've gotten into the trial portion and we're actually have seated the jury, I think when it comes up at that point in time that we have a juror who cannot understand completely the English language or the proceedings going on before him, that is a disability.
Suppose he lived in a different county and that didn't come out until he was already sworn as a juror. Would that be a disability or would that be a disqualification?
I know that there was a case on that previously that out of this county, and I do not recall what the court held on that one, but I think the same scenario or the same analysis would apply if these are things that are not found out prior to court. No, you know what? I would waver on that. I think that would be different because you're going to have to go back to the analysis of whether or not that condition, in your scenario, would be living from being in a different county, would prevent him from being able to fairly and fully perform his duties as a juror. I think the analysis would be different because I don't know, the court would have to go into an analysis on how that would affect his ability to perform, which I think is much different from one's ability to perform when you're looking at their inability to understand the English language. That you're not prevented from understanding or what's occurring and giving a fair and non-biased opinion during a jury trial just because you live outside of the county in which the trial is taking place.
It's an absolute disqualification.
If it's an absolute disqualification, as I've indicated in my brief, I believe an absolute disqualification is different than a disqualification. I think that they're treated differently. I don't believe that not understanding the English language was an absolute disqualification. I believe it could have been raised as a challenge for cause, but was not raised for challenge for cause.
So you're saying it's more akin to being deaf?
I would think, yes, that would absolutely be a better comparison than living outside of a county. If you're deaf and it has not come up, if it's not listed as an absolute disqualification, and it's not found out prior to the seating of the jury panel and trial has started, then it's judged as a disability.
Well, a deaf person can serve with a translator, with an ASL translator. So should the trial court then have gotten a translator for this juror that maybe could write a couple of words of English but couldn't understand any and not found that he was disqualified or suffering from a disability, but rather found him a translator? Should the trial court have done that?
I think that could have been an option. I don't think that it was anything the trial court would have been mandated to do. I think if the defense had requested it, it definitely would have been a least drastic alternative to requesting a mistrial.
What about forcing a juror, a defendant to proceed to trial with 11 jurors over objection?
Well, if it's a disability, which is what the state is arguing, then that is statutorily mandated that you proceed to trial with fewer than 12 jurors if one juror has been found to be disabled.
Only become disabled, though, right?
Well, and that comes back to the language of become disabled or was disabled and how the language is being read. Ms. Moore would argue, she stated that most of my cases were off point and that the amendments were in 2001, which changed that. But the Allen case that I cited was from 2004, which was after the amendment. And so I don't think that the legislature is focused on whether or not you become disabled versus whether you're disabled and it's not determined until after trial has started. The point of the analysis should come down to the two different definitions of disabled, which the Court of Criminal Appeals continues to support as recently as 2012 regarding the mental physical capacity of a person and their ability to fully and fairly participate in their function as a juror. And I think that the word was or did become really is splitting hairs when the point of the statute is the disability at issue and the result of that person's ability to perform as a juror in a case.
Don't you think the real purpose of this statute is that you seat 12 qualified jurors, and then we all understand that there's flu season or deaths that occur, either to a juror, and that is the ultimate disability, but to a family member or loved one, they can't concentrate on the evidence because they're so caught up in that grief. And that this statute is just designed to take into account that life is uncertain and these kinds of things happen, and we're not going to bust a trial and start all over again every time something like this happens. It really, that's the purpose of the statute, isn't it?
The majority of the cases that you see are, that's exactly what they deal with, and that's where it's most notably used. But there are going to be situations, especially in modern society, where we have persons of different cultural backgrounds and that speak different languages on panels, especially in Texas, where you're going to run into communication errors. And I think that if there's
no... Is there anything in the legislative history that would indicate that they envisioned that when they were...
Not that I'm aware of. I wouldn't say that there's anything that this is something that they envisioned. But I think often the law may be envisioned for one purpose and then meet the needs to serve another purpose when it comes along. This by far isn't a circumstance that happens a lot. Even if you look through your case law, it's not very often that you make it through to seating a jury panel and having three witnesses testify before you realize you can't have it. You have a juror seated who does not speak English. I'll admit I was notified of the issue on the day it happened in court.
Do you think perhaps that's because the judges are declaring mistrials when it happens?
No, I don't think that. I mean, there's nothing to support that. I mean, that would just be making a guess, as much of an educated guess as maybe that the during voir dire, people are spending more time in making sure that certain people are speaking, able to meet the requirements to serve on a jury, such as speaking English. Again, I think that's kind of a double-edged sword. If we fall into an area where we're saying you have to determine whether or not these people speak English and completely understand English before you seat them on a juror, otherwise you're going to have a mistrial, well, then we're going to have prosecutors spending time on persons of Hispanic background and not just asking them merely the same questions you're asking the other potential jurors, but maybe spending a little extra time on them and saying, are you just nodding your head and saying yes because that's what you do, or do you really understand what I'm saying? Converse with me and tell me that you understand what I'm saying. I think then we're opening up the door to almost a discriminatory practice in the way that we treat certain people on a jury panel based on the perception of the prosecutor. When the prosecutor should be able to conduct a voir dire with an array of different people sitting in that panel and be able to ask them the same questions and be able to rely.
This could happen with any language. This isn't unique to Spanish. You could have someone from Bosnia who has blonde hair and blue eyes, or someone from anywhere.
Oh, absolutely.
So, I mean, I don't see that it would be discriminatory.
It would be discriminatory if in this situation we have a Hispanic male. And if you were to look at your panel and you have several Hispanic persons who look Hispanic, would it not then be your duty to find out whether or not they speak English before you pick a jury panel?
I think that it is, quite frankly. I think there is a duty on the part of an attorney to fully investigate their panel. The question, though, is not whether one slips through. The question before, I think, the court today, though, is whether if someone slips through because the attorney didn't do that, is that a disqualification or disability? I think that's the issue. I think attorneys should, as a practice.
I agree. I mean, that's the issue. I think we kind of ended up on this because I was trying to address your question regarding asking questions and determining how someone speaks English or not as a disqualification. I absolutely think it's a disability. If it was an absolute disqualification, then that is a different issue as to whether it was just a disqualification that was not learned prior to seating the jury and time for them to raise a challenge for cause because the attorneys or the trial court did not perform their duties diligently to speak specifically to every single person on the panel. And if that person does slip through as they did in this instance, I think then you're looking at a disability because this person is not able to fully and fairly perform the functions of a juror, which is what they've been chosen to do. And that is the definition of a disability. And under that circumstance, under the statute, you're allowed to proceed further through trial with less than 12 members of a jury. Also, I would like to address that Ms. Moore stated that the Rule 44.46 could be applicable to disqualified jurors just as easily. Had the legislator wanted it to do so, they could have added language. I mean, 44 specifically applies to one area of the law, and of course they could have just that converse or the reverse of what Ms. Moore is arguing, they could have changed the language to address any type of situation specifically. But it does not apply to a disqualified juror. And so I think that's another reason why preservation is an issue in this case, because if they 44.46 is specifically designed to help with preservation errors, and it did not apply to disqualified jurors. I see that I'm almost out of time. Does anyone have any additional questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, let me start by saying I apologize if it seemed like I was saying that the state was mischaracterizing the evidence. I did not mean that. I meant misinterpreting. So I do not think Ms. Simmons is mischaracterizing the evidence. I think it's clear that it's a different interpretation than what obviously she thinks that it is. Second, as to this Code of Criminal Procedure 44, I actually was saying that 3629, that if, you know, that's the provision that says you can proceed with 11 jurors. So if the state, I mean, excuse me, if the legislature had intended that that also include disqualifications, not just disabilities, they could have added that language of disqualifications to that particular statute. To answer one of the things that you asked Justice Dauphineau, you were talking about once it's determined somebody's disqualified, is that it? And I think that it is. Basically, 3516 is we get to figure out whether or not these people are disqualified. Once a judge makes a determination as a matter of law that someone's disqualified, then they are disqualified. It is an absolute disqualification, and that is why that person's not able to be seated. We're not talking about a situation where it's questionable about the disqualification. The judge was very clear that she believed that the juror could not read, write, or understand the English language. And that is also why the defense persisted in saying that the juror was never qualified. He said that multiple times in order to point out and distinguish he was not just saying he didn't understand, but that he was never qualified. And then as to the idea of we appoint people if you're deaf, that's a government code statute. I mean, there's specific provision to appoint for a deaf interpreter or each person on a jury that might need their own deaf interpreter, in fact. But there is no likewise statute that makes available an interpreter for a variety of languages that people in the United States might speak or understand or read or write. We don't have anything like that. And maybe someday we'll be at the point where we do need something like that. And I mean, be pretty difficult, I will tell you, as trying to get an Albanian interpreter for a case recently, but that's just not what the law is. It's not required that we do that.
If the juror is seated and it becomes obvious the juror doesn't speak English or understand English, is it an absolute disqualification or is it something that can be cured by providing a translator?
I mean, I see where you're going with this, as in...
No, I don't have any idea.
Well, I mean, in terms of the fact that distinguishing understanding versus reading or writing, as I thought that that's what you're saying, because obviously reading and writing is the absolute disqualification as opposed to, you know, just understanding. You know, I don't think... I guess it would depend upon how the testimony came out as to whether the person was also able to read and write. Because if you can understand but you can't read and write, that's a whole different scenario. It seems likely that a person who could not understand also could not read and write. But I guess I would not know until I was confronted with that, the evidence specifically as to whether or not that would fall in the label of being disabled. And that kind of goes to the Allen case when she was talking about... That one dealt with pre-existing, and actually what they said was, we're not looking at the pre-existing, we're looking at a situation where the person may have had the pre-existing condition of arthritis, but they developed this additional pain and such that became apparent during the trial. Maybe you may not have a pre-existing condition that disqualifies you, but it becomes apparent that other things result from that condition that do make you able to not perform, which is one of the things that they talk about in a lot of the cases dealing with sickness and stuff. The other thing is that I think it really goes to what Justice Sutterith, I'm saying that right, I hope, said, this is not designed, 3629 is not designed for us to fit everything that's a disability or everything that's a disqualification or everything that happens into this disability slot of the statute. There are still instances where a mistrial is the remedy. And I think that's the problem here. We're looking at a situation where we had this issue arise, and the natural inclination is, well, let's try and manipulate it to where this person has a disability because then we can proceed with 11. And that statute was intended to apply in a very limited number of circumstances that are specifically defined, and we shouldn't try and fit everything that goes wrong at a trial into that specific criteria and say that they're disabled and therefore we can proceed with 11. I think probably it's complete speculation, but I think probably it's true that we don't see very many of this weird case because people actually grant mistrials when it happens. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your argument and the trip you had to make, and I hope you get out before it starts freezing again. Your case is submitted, and since you're the last case, you're free to go about your business.